The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the 12th episode of Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I'm your host, Matt Cause, and I got to tell you, we've got some crazy episodes coming up. Not only the head somm from the Shore Club, but winemakers, Daniel Speck from Henry of Pelham, the winemaker from Kloss and Chase, the number one winemaker in Burgundy in terms of no one makes more wine than Jean-Charles Boissette. These are just some of the interviews that are going to be coming up in the next couple weeks. And today it's going to be with James Lochte, who is one of my favorites from Prince Edward County. He makes some of the best Chardonnay and Pinot Noir out there. I fell in love with his winery, which I should say the name, bad podcast host. It's called Long Dog in Prince Edward County. It's hard to find. It's a little bit out of the way, but I highly recommend. Go find it. It's fantastic. Some of the most interesting Pinots and Chardonnays that you will try. He's got a great origin story and how he turned his cottage property in the mid-90s to one of the most important wineries in the county. And also, he's a Gemini Award nominee. He's an editor and producer for IMAX Films. So this guy has got a great story and great wine. That's coming up in a little bit. And I was thinking, if you guys ever want to send me questions for the pod that you want me to answer, mcause56 is my Twitter account. On Instagram, I think I'm Matthew Cause. And my last name, C-A-U-Z, and Matthew. I'm actually not fully sure, which is kind of a bad sign. But, you know, I'm a guy in my 40s. You don't expect me to have my Instagram game, you know, really down pat. So what I want to talk about is Joe_17 wrote a question. And he said, I don't think you've touched on this yet in the wine pod, and probably because it's a really beginner question. But for storing wine, what's best? A fridge, a dark room with a rack in the basement? Not looking for talking about long-term storage, but let's say you've picked up a dozen bottles. I think I mangled Joe's question, but here's the answer. If it's for short-term, like a day or so, you can throw it. You can throw a bottle of wine, especially one that you've opened. If it's one you've opened, I put the seal back on, and I will sometimes throw in the fridge, especially if I can control when I'm going to open it next. Like if I know I'm going to open it again in about an hour and a half, I'll take it out of the fridge just to let it get to the proper temperature, which, by the way, I want to get into in a second. If you're going to hold wine for a little bit longer, even if it's just, you know, a couple of weeks, couple of months, half a year, whatever, you don't need the fancy wine fridge. It helps, but you don't need it. You don't need to have a fully made cellar. It helps, but you don't need it. What you first need is a little piece of darkness. You need somewhere that you're not normally around, a place where there's not a lot of activity, and also a place where you can control the light, where it can be consistently dark. And if it is light, it's just because, you know, you're in the corner and you turn the light on in your basement, you know, so it sees some of that. Don't ever have the wine exposed to sunlight. It's one of the biggest no-nos. It can ruin a wine. Again, not guaranteed that it will, but you're putting your wine at risk. And I got to tell you, I'll never understand. And I'm going on a tangent. All the restaurants, when you see the bar and you see where the wine is, and then you could see sunshine coming in and hitting the wine. I mean, you're ruining your product. I mean, I get it for a lot of it. The wine that's out there is the by the glass stuff, so it's high turnover. And if the sun is hitting it for just a day or so, I mean, it's not going to kill it. It's not going to do anything. That's, you know, that's ridiculous. But at the same time, even for your buy the glass wine, treat it with respect. I know there's issues with shelving and with space, but if I were you, to any wine, or excuse me, restaurant owner, and people getting into restaurants or starting up their own place, keep the wine away from those sort of elements. I know it might be difficult, but it always shocks me. So yeah, keep it somewhere dark, and also more, just important, somewhere cool. You know, it doesn't have to be freezing or anything like that. Just somewhere where there's not going to be wild swings of temperatures. And remember, room temperature is not 2018, I live in a home or a condo room temperature. Room temperature is a concept from, you know, a century, two centuries ago, when everything was just colder because we didn't have the insulation and the heating and just the modern amenities. So room temperature is actually much cooler than what you think it is. I mean, go outside on a spring morning. You know, it's like 5, 6, 7 degrees. You know, somewhere around then, that's what really what they meant by room temperature. Maybe a couple degrees warmer, but yeah, you don't want it too hot. You don't want it, hopefully not a lot of rattling or shaking going on. Just quiet, cool, and dark. And you can leave wine in those sort of conditions for a very long piece of time. And also, lay them on their side. I didn't say that. Lay them on their side. So as long as you got a little nook, a little cranny, somewhere in your basement, wine can be can stay there and you will be safe. You know, certainly if it's 6 months, even up to a year, you'll be okay. If you're buying Bordeaux futures and you want to lay them down for 20 years, you might want to invest in a fridge or even in some sort of wine club where you can store your wine. If you're going to spend that amount of money on the wine and you're saving it, then in those sort of circumstances, you're going to want the best sort of attention and care. I want to speak real quickly about temperature for wine. Never be afraid, and I do this all the time, even if it's by the glass. If you order a red, especially if it's a Pinot Noir, Gamay, Beaujolais, whatever, you know, even Cab Franc, things like that. If it's too warm, or even if it's just warm, ask them to take it back. Ask them, like, hey, I hate to bother, can you throw this in the fridge for a couple minutes? Or if you order a bottle of red and it feels warm, get them to get the chiller bucket out that they would use for white wine and only pour a small little sip for yourself, only like a couple ounces, and wait for that wine, because there's nothing worse for me than really warm red wine. I'd rather it be a little bit cooler out, in the glass, because I can always put my hand over the glass and warm it with my hand. Same thing with white wine. If white wine is too cold, I mean, yeah, it stinks, but just grab it in your hand and hold it for a couple minutes. Don't hold it, but that's why the stem is there, is so that you don't warm the glass. But sometimes if you need to warm the glass, put your hand right on the bowl, right on the glass, and warm it up. And the reason for that is if you don't do such a thing, then the white wine, especially both on the nose and the palate, the taste is going to be muted. You want it just right for white and for red wine. And I know it might seem like a douchey thing to do at a restaurant, but if it's a good restaurant, they'll understand it. And I bet a lot of times the servers are aware that, yeah, our reds are served too warm. So never be afraid. I would always, always, always rather have my red wine to be served a little bit cooler than a little bit warmer. Before I go, and this one's only for if you're in Ontario, I apologize, because this is at the LCBO, but I would recommend the Castelio di Nievi, which, I just said Nievi wrong. It's a Barbaresco. They're Barbaresco. They're 2015. It's like $3 off. It's like $22.95. Castello, Castellodi, and the Nievi, N-E-I-V-E. The Nievi, that's a region in Barbaresco, which is northwest Italy, close to where Turin or Torino, however you want to pronounce it. This is a beautiful Barbaresco. Cherry, some raspberry, plum, little bit of light tobacco, red florality, licorice, well-balanced tannin. For this price point, it's fantastic. You can throw it away for 5-7 years, but you can drink it now, especially, you know, decant it for, you know, hour and a half. Just really well-balanced tannins. I'll talk more about Piemonte somewhere down the road, but I love these wines. If I'm doing my grape rankings, Nebbiolo is right near the top of the list. It easily competes with Pinot Noir, with Cabernet, with Merlot, with Chardonnay, with any of the great grapes. So check it out. It's $3 off at the LCBO. And for other places, wherever you're listening, if you got to spend a couple more dollars, even if it's $25, this is a really well-priced Barbaresco, which can go far more expensive. And listen, you can get higher quality level. This I would consider really damn good entry-level Barbaresco, which at that price point, for me and for my taste, is a steal. Especially with the holiday season. If you grab a bottle of this, bring it to a party, Barbaresco, everyone is going to love this wine. I guarantee it. So yeah, I'm going to talk more about why Piemonte at another podcast is one of my favorite regions to go visit. I hope everyone's having a good holiday season. I wonder if everyone is as full as I am. It's like every day is just a big mound of carbs, sugar, and alcohol. And the shocking thing is, you give me a day and a half away from the parties, and suddenly I'm craving it. I'm like, oh yeah, I can have some glasses of wine. While, you know, the next morning, I'm like, please keep all the indulgence away from me. I am not looking forward to seeing a compare and contrast on the old scale. I probably won't weigh myself. Anyway, enough of me rambling. It is time to get to the interview. I love Long Dog Winery. It's out of the way, but I recommend everyone go visit it. So without further ado, this is a guy who makes movies on IMAX, and this is a guy that makes delicious Pinot Chardonnay and some Pinot Gris and some Rosé, James Lochte. I'm here on location at Long Dog with the owner and winemaker, James Lochte. James, thank you so much for doing the podcast.
Well, thanks for coming, Matt. On a butt-ugly day like today, oh my God, nobody deserves to be out today.
Yeah, and the funny
That's
thing...
That's a long drive.
It was. It was about a little over 2.5 hour drive. Yeah. I think it's worth it, but it's funny. I was supposed to be here last week, and then you warned me because there was tons of snow, and today it's just lots and lots of rain.
Well, thank God it's not snow.
Yeah.
Although, as a winemaker, I prefer snow at this point anyway.
Everything is picked. Everything is out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cleaning up the last of the tanks today.
So a lot to get into. I think the one fun thing is you're the only winemaker or guest I've had where I can go to IMDb to do some of my research for you. For people who don't know, editor and producer for IMAX, do a lot of filmmaking with IMAX. Way back in the day, Gemini Award nominee for Best Picture Editing for Anne of Green Gables.
My God, you've done your research.
Oh, that was easy. And then on top of that, you make really killer Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. That's a hell of a range for a career.
Yeah, well, they're both really quite creative jobs, you know? The filmmaking comes pretty easy. I've really never worked a day in my life. It's all been play.
Mm-hmm.
And
what's harder, Pinot Noir or putting a film together?
Depends on the director. Depends on the subject matter.
Yeah.
I would say that Pinot and Chardonnay are a lot tougher because you're dealing with Mother Nature. And she doesn't. She'll kick you in the head tomorrow.
Yeah.
Right.
Let's get started. A bit of your backstory.
Mm-hmm.
You purchased this property back, I believe it was 1997.
Correct.
And at the time, it was more for vacation and a place to get away. And it wasn't...
Sanity.
Yeah.
It was sanity.
And it was... So,
I had to get out of the city.
So you bought this...
I was an angry man.
You bought this for sanity, and then eventually you got into the insanity of making wine.
You don't want me to interrupt you, though, right?
Oh, no.
Do you mind?
Yes. Oh, no. We'll interrupt each other. It's fine.
Okay, fine. That's like an editing no-no, right? Yeah. I just... we bought this property to basically I needed to get out of the city because I was such an angry man. You know, 30 years in the city, I couldn't drive anymore. I had road rage. I ended up, you know, I tried bicycling but almost got killed, and then skateboarding and rollerblading, and finally walking. We lived, we had a beautiful house in the annex.
Yeah.
And my office was down at Walnut, Basic King and Bathurst.
Oh. Yeah.
It was like 45, 50 minute walk every day.
Yeah.
Which I enjoyed because it was beautiful back streets. But I just got to the point where, why, what's going on here? There's more to life. And I grew up in a small town. My grandparents were Finnish immigrant farmers. So I had this always in my blood. I knew I was going to go full circle from you know, the madness of filmmaking to the madness of winemaking or farming.
And how are you? You know what? Now we're going offline for a second. We're just going to go more interview here. How are you doing now? Like, in terms of if you were angry all the time. And by the way, the annex, try driving in there 2018. It's a disaster.
Yeah.
How are you doing now?
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm still making IMAX films.
Yeah.
But it's on my terms.
Mm-hmm.
And I work with a good buddy, Stephen Lowe, and we've been working together for 30 years. But I work in Montreal, in Dorval, and it's totally different atmosphere there.
Yeah.
I have a beautiful apartment on the Lachine Canal, and it's, you know, it's, and this is my sanity now. I would be dead, Matthew, if I still lived in Toronto.
Really?
Yeah.
Well,
somebody would kill me for road rage,
or
I would have killed somebody else.
All right, one more question about this, and then we will get into wine. But I always, thankfully, I don't have to do a lot of driving, and especially in downtown or in rush hour.
Where do you live?
I live in the Distillery District.
Oh, that's beautiful, though.
Yeah, but I'm right at the DVP, and I do a lot of morning radio.
Right.
So I'm driving north when everyone's coming south, and it's at 4:55 in the morning.
Right.
So I don't have to deal with it. And I always have such sympathy for the people that you see, and you know, they do this every day. They drive to Mississauga and back every day. I always feel such sorry for that.
I can't go back there.
Yeah.
I really can't.
Yeah.
You know, unless one of my friends is sick or you know, there's something that I have to do, I just can't go back to that city. You know, it's cities for young people.
Yeah.
I loved it when I was in my 20s, 30s, and 40s.
Yeah.
But you get into your middle age and you think, oh, man, I need something different.
So I got 7 more years. And I fit 50, and then I'll have to go somewhere else.
Everybody makes those choices, huh?
I'd love to hear just about the genesis of buying a cottage property for sanity to making thousands of cases of wine a year.
Whoa. Well, I'm a pretty mad Finn. And when I explained to my wife, Victoria, that I wanted to put in a few vines just because I got to have a project. And I love growing stuff. I've always loved growing stuff.
Yeah.
In the city, I had a lovely vegetable garden. So when I got out here, things went a little wild. And I started doing research. I did over 100 test holes on the property and realized, oh, can't show you because we're not on TV, but this is some of the best calcareous limestone, 465 million years old, Ordovician limestone. There is no better. Not only the dirt is great, it's sitting at between North 43 and 45 latitude, where Pinot Noir and Chardonnay just have the best time.
And for people that are listening, just the more wine enthusiast, if you go to Burgundy and you trace where all the Grand Cru vineyards are, you're going to find underneath is a line of limestone that it's following it, you know, it's following along with it.
Yeah, yeah. But ours is better.
Really?
It's better, not only because it's older,
mm-hmm.
but it's virgin. It was never abused. I mean, this field behind us here was a pumpkin patch when we bought the property.
You went from a pumpkin patch to making some of the best Pinot in Ontario. That's and Chardonnay. That's crazy.
I knew when I'd finished the research that we were sitting on a gold mine in terms of growing great Pinot and Chardonnay.
Yeah.
And, I mean, if you looked at a big picture, you would never do anything.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, okay, well, I'm going to put 1,000 vines in. Then I'm going to put another 3, another 4. And they just kept getting better and better and better. And the first fruit we got off in year 3 was spectacular. Mm-hmm. Absolutely beautiful.
And that was, I think it was 99, you planted 1,200 vines.
Correct.
2,000, 3,700. 2001, 7,000, including some Pinot Gris.
Mm-hmm.
And then May of 2004, you began selling wine.
Correct.
So within a 7-year period, you went from I need a hobby to now I'm selling, you know, a couple thousand cases of Pinot and Chard.
Yeah, and it wasn't all that good in the beginning. In fact, I dumped a lot of wine because I wasn't happy with it. I mean, I'm a wine lover. I have to digress for a second because when I was 19th, I spent a year in Europe on a motorcycle.
I know. I was going to get to that.
Oh, okay.
You go ahead. I have your whole story here.
Oh, okay.
And it's the perfect, that's the perfect way to be a wine lover, but I'm not going to spoil it. Explain a motorcycle and a baguette.
Okay. First of all, I grew up in Northern Ontario. My dad was a mining engineer in Elliott Lake. And I mean, he made homemade rhubarb wine and chokecherry wine. It was just disgusting. But my buddies and I drank a lot of it, right?
Yeah.
Because it was free. So, but I never, I mean, he drank like Mogan David and, you know, really terrible, terrible wine. So I had no idea what it was like. I mean, we drank out to sea with old, what was it called?
It was Blue Nun, Thunderbird.
No, the Sherry.
Oh, the Sherry. Harvey Bristol Cream.
Bristol Cream and out to sea with Old Sailor.
Okay, I haven't heard of that
one. Old Sailor was like $1.10 a bottle, right? That was in the 60s.
Yeah.
Anyway, I decided after a miserable year of failing at university, I said, I have to do something. So I was lucky enough to get a job in the mine for a couple of years, saved a lot of money, and said, sayonara, I'm going to Europe. I want to see what the world is about because I may never get another chance. So here I am driving along and going to Burgundy. Had my first bottle of Neuilly Saint-Georges, and I thought, wow, this is something else. This isn't wine. This is like an elixir. And it was always stuck in the back of my head, right? So I drove my motorcycle literally with a baguette and some cheese and a bottle of wine and toured all over Europe.
That, as someone who works in film and in entertainment, your origin story is, that would almost be too much on the nose.
Like, I know.
If you were watching that in a movie, like, that's such a stereotype. Right. Yeah. A motorcycle on your own, Burgundy, a baguette, that is the ideal origin story for getting into wine.
Yeah, and you know, Matthew, the best wine I had wasn't the Neuilly Saint-Georges. Mm-hmm. It was some really strange varietals in Crete, in Greece.
Oh, yeah?
Spectacular. Sitia. These are ancient, ancient old varietals. You know, big, thick, heavy, juicy, unbelievable. 17 cents a bottle that you could go to the wine store and just take it right out of the barrel.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. That's where my love of Moussaka came.
Okay. Yeah. So you mentioned that a lot of the wine you made early on wasn't that good. What are some of the biggest differences for you as a winemaker in 2018 than 2004?
Well, I'm smarter. As a winemaker, I'm smarter. I'm a better grape grower, for sure. And the grapes that I have are a lot smarter. They know what they're doing now. They're not babies. You know, they don't have root systems that are down a foot or so.
Yeah.
They're now down 5, 6, 7, 8 feet. I don't know, you know. Yeah. And they're down into that beautiful, beautiful limestone that I discussed earlier. And I just know how to grow good grapes.
Mm-hmm.
That's my passion.
Yeah.
The winemaking part of it comes easy if you have good fruit.
Yeah.
I mean, and every good winemaker will say, hey, it's a piece of cake. If you've got the right varietal planted on the right soil under the right conditions, bingo.
Was there a moment for you in 2000, like between 99, say, and 2004, was there that eureka moment when you realized, wait a minute, I need to start selling this. This is more than just for friends and family.
Well, the first vintage that I got some Pinot off my A block, my oldest vines, was 2002. Mm-hmm. And I only got 3 barrels off 5,000 vines. But that wine was so spectacular. Now, it was youngish, fruity, you know, boisterous Pinot.
Yeah.
But it convinced me that this is not pretend. I mean, somebody in this county is going to make the best Pinot Noir and Chardonnay in the world. I'm convinced of that. It may not be my generation, but wait till those vines are 30, 40, 50 years old.
Yeah.
If you look after them, absolutely, I'm convinced of that.
How old are your vines right now around?
Our oldest vines are, the oldest ones are going into their 20th summer next year.
Which is, that's rare. I mean, there are other ones, but in Ontario, I mean, in Canada in general, having vines that are 15 plus years old, that's the exception versus the...
Yeah. I mean, Niagara has some, you know, very old Marshall Foch and you know, Speck Brothers have some old vines.
Yep.
Gamay.
Mm-hmm.
Okanagan, I'm not sure how old they are. They're probably in the 20s or some of the oldest. There might be some 30 and 40 year old vines there too.
Yeah, that's just
the crazies, the guys who started early.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Anyone who does anything the first, you're always crazy.
Of course.
You'll eventually be looked back as a trailblazer, as historic, as a genius.
Yeah.
But at the time,
you're an idiot.
You're crazy.
Of course.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, these old farmers who saw me, like, I had this guy who showed up one day just after we bought the property. His name was Glenn Storing, and he looked just like my dad. And it was weird because my dad just died 3 months before we bought this property. Sadly, he never saw this because he would have loved it. Anyway, Glenn showed up one day and he said, this guy was a genius, unbelievable genius. Anyway, he showed up, he says, I hear you're going to put in a vineyard and try some grapes, and I think you're crazy, but I'm a mechanic, I'm a carpenter, I'm a plumber, and I know you want some renovations done on your property. I like to get paid $20 an hour every 2 weeks. He worked for us for 10 years.
Wow.
He and I became the best buddies. We cut all these posts off our land, put them in the ground. And every day he'd just shake his head and look at me and say, "You're nuts. You're absolutely nuts." But there was something that intrigued him about my ability to go out there and work with him every day, you know? And the other farmers would come by and gawk and say, "What the hell is this guy doing? What, like, nobody's done this, you know?" Ed Neuser over at Wapoose, he had some hybrid vines in the ground, but there was nobody else.
Yeah.
Richard and Vita were starting to put some in the ground, but I mean, it was really scary.
And if you do the hybrids, at least you're more protected against the elements.
Of course.
You're doing, you know,
vinifera. Yeah. I was not going to compromise.
No, you weren't going to do any hybrids.
We could
spend a lot of time talking about hybrids. And,
yeah.
you know, if I go with movie analogy again, you know what you remind me of?
Mm.
Kevin Costner from the baseball movie where he
Field of Dreams.
Field of Dreams, where he cuts all the
build it and they will come.
So he puts a baseball diamond, gets rid of a lot of his corn, and everyone thinks he's nuts.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, but you know what? It was a hard struggle. I mean, the government is against you. You know, there are a lot of hurdles. I mean, it's a lot tougher than the film business.
I want to get in the government in a sec. I mean, there's 100 things.
And, yeah, I know.
And by the way, you let me know when you're like, "Matt, can you please leave?" I keep talking with you. But you mentioned earlier in the interview just about how, you know, you put the right grapes in the right spot. Mm-hmm. One criticism I always had with Ontario wine, and it's far less now than when it was, say, in 2000, was everyone would try to plant everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then everyone would try to plant and make single varietal Cabernet Sauvignon, which is a ridiculous thing for so many vintages. And that, for me, was always the biggest mistake I always saw from winemakers. And I always say that respectfully from someone looking from 10,000 feet away. I was just wondering your thoughts on just some of the grapes that get grown, and what do you think are some of the number one mistakes that people can make?
Well, you know, climate change is real.
Yeah.
It's very real. And as a farmer, just in 20 years being here, things are changing very fast. So that has a big effect on what varietals you can put in the ground now.
Yeah.
You know, maybe in 10 or 15 years from now, you're going to be able to grow Tempranillo, Malbec. Who knows?
That would be depressing. I have to say that to me, that would be scary. I don't want to live in a world where Ontario makes single varietal Tempranillo or even Cabernet Sauvignon. And I've tasted every now and then a good year of it,
mm-hmm, yes.
but not consistently.
Not consistently. No. Well, getting back to your original question, I mean, when I did the research, I said, well, there are only two, maybe three, maybe four grapes that are going to consistently ripen in our climate here. And those are Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Pinot Gris, and Gamay.
Yeah.
Riesling is a tough. I had some Riesling vines in the ground, but I pulled them out because they just killed me. They were so frustrating.
Really?
Yeah, they never ripened. They were all like, they were always like diesel fuel, you know?
Yeah.
The juice was, I mean, they looked pretty, but the acidity was, I mean, you know.
It's funny, everyone always says Pinot Noir is the nickname, the heartbreak grape. And for you, it was Riesling.
Yeah. Pinot loves it here. It just loves it.
I agree.
Yeah, it's Pinot and Chardonnay. In fact, you know what? Chardonnay's starting to win my heart too.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great grape.
All right,
and it's got a bad rap.
It does. Okay, let's go there. Then I want to get to government, and then I want to talk about Prince Edward versus Niagara, just in terms of characteristics, how they're similar or different. But it always shocks me when someone says anything but Chardonnay, because mm-hmm. like, A, you dummy. Mm-hmm. Where do you think champagne comes from? And I always, whenever they say that, I'm like, okay, I guess you won't have any Montrachet. I'm going to put it away now. Mm-hmm. Or, okay, have some Steely Chablis, or, you know, beautiful stuff from here, or Hawke's Bay, or mm-hmm. Margaret River. Like, mm-hmm. to me, it's ridiculous. Like, just, what do you say to the ABC, the anything but Chardonnay crowd?
Well, sadly, because it's the world's most widely planted grape, it is.
Yeah.
So it's California. Wherever you can put it in the ground, it's a bit of a prostitute Chardonnay, you know? It'll lay down anywhere. I hate to use that analogy, but it
works.
And sadly, because it is planted so widely, it doesn't show its best effort in hot climates. Mm-hmm. Like some of that Chardonnay from California. How does Bin 65 Lindeman's make the same Chardonnay every year? Explain to me that.
Hmm.
You know, that's chemical wine.
Yes, it is.
It's totally chemical wine.
Yeah.
But when Chardonnay struggles, like Pinot, when you get those cool nights, hot days in September, like we do here in the county, and Niagara, it produces some exceptional, exceptional wine. And people come in here. I bet you I've converted 4,000 or 5,000 people. They come in here, I don't like Chardonnay.
Yeah.
I said, what do you mean you don't like Chardonnay? Well, it's all too oaky and it's... I said, that's industrial Chardonnay. Here, try it. Try this. And they go, oh, this is Chardonnay? Out they go with 3 or 4 bottles.
Right? There you go. Good.
Yeah. So what, that's the testament.
Do you understand the temptation of winemakers who get the chemicals and the designer yeasts? Because a lot of people crave consistency. And one thing about your wines, and it reminds me of Pearl Morset as well in Niagara, where we always talk about vintage variation. Some wineries really embrace it. Others, J-Lore tastes the same pretty much every year. But I understand it from an economic decision. I'm curious your thoughts on that.
The thing about... I'm only going to talk about Pinot because that's my real passion.
Yeah.
The thing about Pinot, and most people don't understand, it doesn't know it's a grape. It doesn't know it's a grape. One year, it's going to be full of black cherry. Next year, it's going to be vanilla and chocolate. Next year, it's going to be black raspberry. Another year, under ripe year, it's going to be, you swear you're eating a wild blueberry.
Yeah.
So how can you possibly make the same wine every year? You can't. And who wants to get the same Christmas present every year?
Yeah.
You know? So I love the fact that it's never the same.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the beauty of it. Because you stick your nose in that first ferment and you say, whoa, where did that come from? You know? That's the fun of it.
How are your 2015s? I remember I was here a couple years ago and I barrel tasted some of your 2000. Oh, wow. Actually, and honestly, people, because this is an audio, so you can't see. James just put up a bottle. When I was here the last time, and it was about 2 years ago.
That was a big frost year.
Yeah. Huh?
Where everybody got wiped out.
Yeah. But you proclaimed to me, like, this could be the best one I've made. Your 2000, and it was still in barrel. So, you know, things can happen. How is your 2015 doing?
Well, you want a taste?
I mean, I'm not going to, I drove, you know, I'm not going to say, I'm not going to, now, at the same point, this was not on purpose.
No.
I'm not here to weasel, you know, free Pinot, but I never say no to it.
It's a very earthy, complex Pinot.
Now, as I'm sniffing it, what does the government do that makes your job so difficult?
Oh, you know, it's because the alcohol rules in this province are archaic. I mean, it's just, the whole thing needs to be revamped. The VQA has to be revamped. The LCBO has to be revamped in terms of treating winemakers and wineries in this province. I mean, there's no other jurisdiction in the world that puts so many restrictions on what we can do here.
Yeah. I always describe the LCBO as half draconian and half paternalistic when it comes to alcohol.
Yeah, I agree. But, you know, like here in the county, I've been asking, let us open our own stores. We put together a consortium of guys who are growing pure Prince Edward County wine. Let's put a store right beside the LCBO. Allow me to do that. You're still going to get the taxes.
Yeah.
I'm not taking the tax, but we'll see where the loyalty lies. I'll bet you we're busier than the LCBO because people want it.
I'll talk about the wine. It's my main problem I've always had with Ontario is just, you know, it's a monopoly. And I understand the LCBO does a lot of good things, especially if you live in some smaller rural areas. But what I would like to see is you have the LCBO, but you also have, if you want to start your own specialized wine store, allow that as well. Allow a store which is just Burgundy. And it doesn't have to be just from Burgundy, but just Chardonnay and Pinot from around the world.
Right.
But a Prince Edward County, the great thing with that is then you could taste the difference between Norm Hardy or Kloss and Chase or Stanners or you, and you could discover which one is your favorite or which one you like. This one's closer to the water. This one's more in the interior. Can you tell the difference? I think it'd be fantastic, and also it'd be a great little way just for people to learn more about wine.
Absolutely, and my point is they wouldn't get shortchanged on the taxes. In fact, they'd make more money
because
we'd be selling more wine.
Yeah, absolutely.
But why? They don't want the competition? I don't understand. I just don't get it. Yeah. I think it's like this draconian like you said, a draconian idea.
Yeah, a lot of, you know, the earthy and the mushroom is there. It's a very soft wine,
mm-hmm.
like this Pinot. Red fruit dominant, some spice, very fresh fruit, nothing ripe. And also just whatever the alcohol is, what I appreciate is that this cannot be a high alcohol wine.
It's 13.1.
13.1?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's nothing worse than trying, and thank you, by the way, the 15 is fantastic.
Yeah, it's lovely.
There's nothing worse than, and there's a lot of good California wine, obviously, but when you try like a Sonoma, like Costa Brown, a Pinot Noir I used to love, and then one day I woke up and my palate just changed, and I remember looking, it was 15.5% alcohol. I'm like, that should not be the alcohol level for Pinot.
No.
You know, which I just, at a certain point, it needs to, it hits a bit of a ceiling.
Absolutely. I mean, that over, well, they're not Pinots.
Yeah.
It's
Pinot Syrah blend.
Yeah. They've convinced the California, mostly the California public and the American public that this is Pinot Noir, but it's not. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, there are some in Santa Ynez, in the Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
There are some lovely, lovely Pinots up there.
Mm-hmm.
But they're much more like mine than they are, you know, those hot, super extracted Pinots.
I want to talk a little bit about just winemaking. And I found this quote from you. Mm. The minute you pick the grapes, they start to break down. The quicker you can get them cool, the better your chances of making a good wine like Chardonnay or Pinot. I'm just curious, what is a day in the life like for James when it comes time to pick the grapes?
Well, that's when I become Jekyll and Hyde. I mean, I've had the same pickers for about 15 years now.
Yeah.
And I don't have picking parties because people show up and they end up cutting the end of their fingers off and I end up in an emergency. So my rule of thumb is, here's what we do, guys. We pick when it's cool. I really pull the plug. Once it gets over 18, 20 degrees, pull the plug. So we start early. From the time my Pinot is picked to the time I get it to 5-6 Celsius, crushed into stem in my cool room, never more than half an hour. Because
mm-hmm.
everything wants it, right? The fungus wants it. Nasty yeast wants it.
Yeah.
The ladybugs want it. Everything wants it.
Yeah.
But I want it more.
Yeah.
So that's my rule of thumb. So I'm a bit of a Nazi when it comes to that.
You mentioned you've used the same pickers. And it's one thing I've never talked about in this podcast. And I find in so many great wineries, it's the same thing. They have the same people. I was wondering if you could explain to the listener, because we don't think about the people picking the grapes. We love the idea of, oh, it's hand-picked. Oh, good. It's artisanal and it's higher quality. But we don't actually discuss the hands, the arms, and more importantly, the brains and the eyes of the pickers.
Absolutely. I mean, most of my pickers are women. Mm-hmm. And they start calling me sort of early September. And they say, okay, James, when are we picking? When are we picking? And of course, if the fruit looks beautiful, I mean, you can just look at those beautiful bunches of Chard and Pinot and say, wow, you know, it's like a thrill. And you get to taste them at the same time. There's something very visceral and something that goes to your brain, like a primordial part of your brain, picking fruit. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what we do. We are fruit eaters.
Yeah.
And so they're conscientious. You know, I don't get leaves in there. I have to do very little sorting. Everything is sorted on the vine. They know exactly how much, if there's a little botrytis there, pick a little botrytis.
Yep.
You know, if there's too much, scrape it off.
Mm-hmm.
Not that we get a lot of botrytis, but every once in a while,
yeah.
you'll get a year with some botrytis.
Your Chardonnays, one thing I've noticed in the past, and this might be just a bad tasting note by me, or just I wasn't on my game. But every now and then, and I like it because it's not all the time. Again, you don't want every vintage to taste the same.
Of course not.
I have tasted a little bit of oxidation, and in a good way, where uh-huh. it feels like you've introduced a little bit of oxidation, which can give it a bit of a funky note. You can get a little bit of honey or nuts, or just you can get some different things. I'm curious. Am I incorrect? Was that ever part of your process for any of your Chardonnays?
Well, I tend to leave a lot of my leave the Chardonnay in barrel a lot longer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a big sulfite guy.
Yep.
So
okay. Yeah.
You know, I'm not overdosing it with sulfite.
Yep.
Every once in a while, there's a little bit of oxidation, but I certainly prefer that to reduction.
Yeah.
And an acid test. Mm-hmm. You know, and people seem to like. And I like a little bit of oxidative nature.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't like a lot of it. VA, I will throw out immediately.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? A little oxidation is not bad.
What's one thing you'll hear is people that just get into wine, like Ontario wine, isn't that all the same? I hate doing the generalizations, but is there any sort of boilerplate differences that you notice between Pinot or Chard, which is what you make, from Prince Edward County versus Niagara?
You know,
and maybe no. I just, you guys, it's different temperature, different soil. So I just wondering.
I taste a bit of Niagara Chardonnay, not a ton of it. I have to go back to Temkin Pascus. That was the first time I had some Ontario Chardonnay that blew me away.
Mm-hmm.
When Deborah Pascus was working with Temkin, they picked, I don't know, I think it was the Wismer Vineyard in Niagara.
Yeah.
And this Chardonnay was so spectacular. I mean, it was better than Montresor or Mousseau. And I said, whoa, how did they do this stuff? But because I'm not a... I don't buy a lot of Niagara Chardonnay.
So, yeah.
I mean, you know, people give it to me. Most of it is sort of table wine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're going to be killing me for that. But trust me, you know, a lot of it is $15, $16 a bottle.
Yep.
And a lot of wineries don't have a premium Pro Morisset and a few other ones. They have some very good. But, you know, you got to hang on to it. It's got to be in barrel for, you know, 24 months.
You mentioned the vineyard, Wismer Vineyard, and it's funny. It's one of the ones I always remember.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's one thing that maybe the LCBO and VQA and everyone's got to do a better job of doing, and this is now a common theme on my podcast, is to drill down, you know, just that this sub-appellation does this versus this one does this. Like, I think we'd be at a great point if you saw on the label Wismer Vineyard, and you're mm-hmm. like, oh, okay, I know that that's a... In a lot of years, that'll be a higher quality of Chardonnay.
Right.
And I think if you did it, it would push that the quality that exists here because you get that in other parts of the world.
Yeah, I think a lot of wineries are doing that now. They're doing separate blocks. This is the X block. This is
yeah.
You know, they're branding it.
Mm-hmm. yeah, more branding, I think would help.
Yeah, yeah, I'm with that. You know, it's so hard because... In the end, you say, okay, well, I'm going to do my D block, clone 96 Chardonnay. That's going to be the vineyard label brand. But then, you know, you get to 2 years down the road and you start tasting your barrels and here's a 4-star barrel. Here's a 2-star barrel.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm going to make the best wine that I feel is I can make from these barrels. And
yeah.
If it doesn't have a vineyard designation, so be it, you know?
Where's Prince Edward County now versus when you started? What are some of the biggest differences beyond, obviously, you know, an expansion of the amount of wineries out there?
well, certainly people have discovered us.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, people have found or how do I say it? They've become loyal to certain vineyards and they expect a certain quality now, and I think it's mostly because there's such good word of mouth, there's such good buzz.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, I'm disappointed that a lot of the wineries still bringing stuff from Niagara, which is sacrilege to me.
Yeah.
Because if you did that in Burgundy or...
Oh, my God. If you did that, you'd be arrested.
Guillotine.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, that part of it, and sadly, I mean... There's a huge percentage of the wine that's sold in this county that doesn't come from here.
Yeah.
And that's sad because we can make good wine.
It's always, yeah, it is always weird when you go somewhere and you can see, you know, you see where the fruit is from. And why do wineries do that? Is it just because it's easier? I mean, it's just
it's the economics.
It's the economics of it,
and
yeah.
You know what? A lot of people won't do the work.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work. Look at those hands, you know?
Yeah, oh, yeah. And as
you know, and if you're, you don't want to lie in bed and spoon with your girlfriend,
yeah.
you know, Mother Nature is kicking the shit out of your vineyard.
Yeah.
So you got to get on the tractor. You got to do those things. You got to spray. You got to walk the vineyard.
Have you had a bad injury?
No.
That's good.
No, I'm pretty careful.
Yeah.
Growing up on a farm, that was sort of instilled, you know?
Because you got sort of a little bit mangled, not mangled hands, but yes, you do.
That's from the mouse. That's from editing all those years.
Oh,
that's
really?
Oh, yeah.
Wait a minute. So your hands, it's more
look
from
at that,
editing.
Perfect.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Your left hand is perfect. Your right. That's hilarious.
Well, it's also farming. It's gotten worse over the years.
But. Yeah, yeah, yeah. where would you like to be? Like, where? What are you hoping for? Like what are the next 5-10 years for you? I mean, maybe you don't have a plan, but I'm curious just where you would like to see Long Dog be the next 5-10 years.
I love this rain to stop right now.
Yeah. Me too.
Starters. Oh my God.
I got a bunch of driving to do today.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're not going to plant anymore because my wife Victoria won't allow me.
Yep.
I would like to do a little experimenting, believe it or not, with a couple of hybrids.
Mm-hmm.
Marquette, for one.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know that grape.
I don't. I was in my head trying to go the Rolodex of information.
Okay. Marquette is a grape that came on stream about, I can't remember where it was developed. I think maybe Minnesota or Cornell. It's got both sides. It's got Pinot Noir as a grandparent.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm an anti-hybrid guy. Most of them taste like shit.
I mean,
they're just foxy or just, you know, they've got something wrong with them.
Yeah.
But a friend of mine whose family has been growing Marquette in Pennsylvania on Lake Erie, South Shore, brought me a bottle a couple years ago. And he said, James, here, why don't you try this? And I said, Steve, So... I poured it and nosed it and thought, whoa, what do we have here? And he didn't tell me what the grape was. He just said, this is some wine that we make. Well, my first taste, I was convinced. Now, I've had some Marquette from other places that didn't even come close. But his brother is a winemaker. He's like, in fact, they came to visit me. It was a great, he was like, he's an 82-year-old winemaker. He took over the family business in Erie. And I said, wow, what? I mean, this is good wine. Now, I got a letter from the VQA 2 days ago. They want to make Marquette a VQA wine now.
Okay.
And there's going to be a lot of resistance.
Yeah.
Because it is easy to grow. And da, 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 da. But it's not as winter hardy as some of the other ones.
Mm-hmm.
So it still has to, you know, and it's not as disease resistant. But I'll tell you, Matthew, that was good wine.
Okay.
Good so wine.
Something to keep an eye on down
the
road.
Yeah, you can Google it later.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I wanted to say this to near the end, the story behind the name.
Long Dog.
Yeah. I mean, I love wiener dogs or dash hounds. I had a girlfriend who always had them in her house. I'm just curious the story.
Well, it goes back to Victoria's dad, my father-in-law, who's still alive. He had a wire-haired dachshund during the war. Called Adolf. And it lived in, he was a rifleman, a 19-year-old major. And this dog.
Wait, how old is it? We're talking World War, I mean.
Two.
World War II.
Right.
Damn.
Yeah. He's still alive. There's his picture right there.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Yeah. That's fantastic.
Yeah. And as a side note, he was captured and he spent some time in a prisoner of war camp with Camilla's father.
Camilla Scott Bolt?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. In fact, when they were here last summer,
yeah,
Victoria wrote to Camilla and said, we'd love to give you some wine.
Yeah.
And she wrote back.
Excuse me.
She wrote back and said, no. If your father can make it, please, we want to meet him.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So anyway, so getting back to the dachshund thing.
Yeah.
Edward had a wire-haired dachshund called Adolf.
Yeah.
And Victoria kept saying to me, I want a dachshund. She grew up with dachshunds. Her family had dachshunds, 5 or 6 of them.
Yeah.
So on her 30th birthday, I kept looking and looking for a dachshund. Finally, we found one. Wire-haired standard has to be this dog.
Yeah.
So that was Otto, the wonder dog, hence the name.
Hence the name, Otto.
Hence the name, Otto.
Yep.
So we tried everything, mm-hmm. like our names, Rose, Lottie, Rapkin. That doesn't sound very good. Yeah. Lottie, Rose, Rapkin. Da, da, da. So we tested it on a bunch of our friends and said, what do you think of Long Dog? Put a smile on everybody's face. Right?
Yeah.
And it's not pretentious.
No. Nope.
No, it's not like naming something after yourself.
Yeah.
I'm not that insecure.
Speaking of which, that goes to my final question.
Uh-huh.
Better winemaker slash, who's better winemaker slash filmmaker? You or Francis Ford Coppola?
Oh, ooh, I wouldn't. I mean, we do totally different genres.
Very safe. That's right. A very safe answer.
Well, you know, he's a genius.
Yeah, he is. Yes.
He's a genius.
Yes, he is.
And he's an Italian genius, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
Makes great wine, fantastic wine. Anybody who makes that effort and gambles on a winery, to me is, you know, close to my heart.
Yeah. Well,
but I'm a documentary filmmaker. I'm a totally different guy. I mean, I started out in drama. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You've done your research with the Anne of Green Gables and stuff, but I just got tired of drama because I just felt somehow it was a bit false. And I love learning stuff. And with
hence the Marquette.
Yeah. And with the IMAX films, I mean, I've done some amazing stuff. I'm, you know, without stupid name dropping, but I got to meet Jane Goodall and became a good friend of hers.
Wow.
We did a racing film with Paul Newman and Mario Andretti.
Yeah.
And they became good friends.
Yeah.
You know, I've been to the Arctic. Da, 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 da. It's, you know, it's just, I don't know. If you can do one or two things really well in this life,
yeah,
that's all you can expect, you know? I had a great grade five teacher. Her name was Teresa Brewer. I'll never forget, because I was like a bit of an ADD kid, you know, trying to do too many things at one time. She said, James, try doing one thing well. And that's sort of been my moniker, my motto, right?
It's a great one. It's a great philosophy in life. And, I mean, what a fascinating life from working in the mines,
mm-hmm.
motorcycle in Burgundy, making films, making wine. That's a pretty good couple of fascinating sentences.
Matthew, anybody can do it.
Yeah.
Anybody can do it. You just have to have the will.
Yeah.
Right? And the world wants you to fail.
Mm-hmm.
You know? The world wants you to fail. Like all these guys, you know, they said, a lot of you're nuts. And I remember working in the mine.
Yeah.
All these guys said, you're going to Europe, you'll never make it.
Yeah.
You're going to film school, you'll never make it. You know, it's like, there's so much negative. I feel sorry for kids now because they're inundated.
Yeah.
With all this information and it's overload. You know, how do you make that decision to do it right?
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll end it here. Hopefully somewhere down the road, I'd love to interview you again because there's still plenty of stuff and quotes and things. But again, I recommend to everyone, it's a little bit out of the way. It's worth your drive.
Yeah.
Come to the Long Dog Winery. Some of the best Chardonnay and Pinot you will try in Ontario, in Canada. It's a really cute little wine tasting room. I try to come here every time I'm in Prince Edward County. It's really pretty. James, really appreciate it, sir.
Thank you for making the trip out here, Matthew, on a shitty day like today.
Absolutely. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Again, subscribe, iTunes, Stitcher, Audio Boom, wherever good podcasts are sold. And once again, everyone, happy hunting.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.